you can host the best backyard barbecue. When you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside, repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.
Hi, this is Josh Marshall, and this is the Josh Marshall Podcast. We have the impeachment trial still underway. We're, I guess, 2 of 3 days into the prosecutor's presentation of the case.
Long nights, some long days.
Well, it's almost crazy. It's almost crazy to think about what it would have been like if they would have kept to that back-to-back 12-hour days.
It would have been up until like 2 in the morning every night instead of just one night.
Yeah, because obviously 12 hours is not... just 12 hours.
Exactly. There's some breaks and there's some
15
kind of
hours
delays,
or something like that.
Plus, you can't even start until the afternoon because of Don Roberts' schedule. So. Yeah.
Right. Is that actually why they're...
Yeah, I believe so. Yeah. It's like morning, like arguments in the morning and then impeachment in the afternoon.
Oh, I didn't realize that.
Yeah, like on Tuesday night when it went until about 2 in the morning when the rules resolution was finally passed.
Right.
Roberts had to be in court at 10 the next morning for, like, to hear a case.
It's funny because at first I thought, Kate, you were saying kind of like, you know, he's not going
to
change his schedule. He's got golf or something.
In, so.
Yeah, exactly.
No, he's doing double duty.
So, yeah, okay, that's legit. But I almost kind of think like, all right, Supreme Court, like you're pretty important, but like maybe shift it around
that's
a little bit.
That's what I'm saying. It's like they only hear like so many cases a year. Take 2 weeks off.
Yeah,
you know, it's fine.
Exactly. It's a little ridiculous. All right. Well, we have a very special episode for this episode. Before we get to all that awesomeness, let me quickly remind you that the Josh Marshall Podcast is brought to you by Grady's Cold Brew Iced Coffee. Do you love saving, we saw this after the last episode where we discussed, like, you know, coffee shops. Why are there coffee shops? You should be buying
exclusively Grady's.
Yeah, exclusively Grady's, and it's, you know, we're going to discuss, you save money, Grady's, and it's better than whatever you're having at your local coffee shop. There was someone on Twitter who wrote in like heartbroken. I don't know if she owns a coffee shop or is just like coffee shop adjacent, but like felt betrayed.
Right.
That we've come out and said how coffee shops are evil.
I'm not against coffee shops. I think I was playing it up just a little bit last week, but
I guess I was.
We just have to ride for Grady's, you know.
How can we
not?
It's just New York coffee shops. I'm sorry, it's a stressful experience.
That's true. So along those lines, do you love to save a buck by skipping the coffee shop? Of course you do. Of course you do. We've already discussed how. You do not want to be in a coffee shop. So is Grady's Cold Brew. Grady's Cold Brew is also against coffee shops. You asked and they delivered. Brew it yourself with Grady's New Orleans style coarse ground coffee blend designed to work in any cold or hot coffee maker. One bag makes 24 servings of Grady's Cold Brew exactly the way you want it. You can order it online and receive 16 ounces of their famous blend of 100% Arabica beans and French chicory in a resealable pouch for long-lasting freshness. Ready to give it a swirl? Get 20% off your first order at gradyscoldbrew.com with promo code TPM. And if you're just like, you know, you don't have it and you know, it would be that or go to the coffee shop or you need it right away, you can order it on Amazon.com for next day delivery.
If you need to help Jeff Bezos in his moment of need after his phone was...
Yeah, exactly. So today we have our normal hosts and we have a special guest, my friend Carrie Antholis. Who? Hey,
hi, Josh.
Hey, what's up?
I'm delighted to be here.
Yeah. Well, you and I have been, I guess I've been friends for like a decade, maybe upwards of a decade.
Yep.
Now we are collaborating on Crime Story, which for readers of the site, TPM is sort of playing an incubator role in the launch of this new site, Crime Story, and you can actually see it if you're a TPM reader, you see a little section of the front page that has stories from Crime Story. So we're gonna talk about that, but we're also gonna talk about the news and the impeachment trial and some stuff about Bill Barr and a lot of stuff, because what Carrie is doing with Crime Story is looking at, we know about the sort of the true crime thing, right? That thing in popular culture and media and entertainment, true crime. And it's a whole spectrum of stuff from sort of like highbrow to lowbrow. And we also have, at the same time, the politics of crime and justice have transformed in recent years. Carrie and my age, it used to be for ages in the public political discourse, the only discussion of crime is, are you tough on crime or extremely tough on crime? or being tough on crime isn't, you know, so that's the whole thing. And in the last few years, that has changed significantly. And we have a whole public conversation about a concept that didn't even used to exist, mass incarceration. And it's this is, and you also have around the country now, the election of, what's Krasner's first name?
Larry Krasner,
right. Yeah. One of the first high profile examples of this was in Philadelphia 2 years ago, I think. And it's sort of bubbling around the country, where you have progressive DAs, people who are getting elected district attorneys on a platform of dramatic change in how we approach law enforcement and crime and rehabilitation and all these things. So, and now, maybe, you know, this has been bubbling sort of on the progressive left, but it is true that there's even a kind of a wing of this movement on the right, at least
on the libertarian right.
Yeah, on the libertarian right, and I think that there's at least some recognition around law enforcement about drugs, some recognition that, like, okay, you know, it's at the, there's just too many people in prison. It's and I think, Carrie, you're right. It's on the libertarian right, because both libertarian in the sense of just we got too many people in prison, too much power of, you know, kind of incarcerating power of the state. And there's also a kind of a part of this that is about just money. Mm-hmm. We spend a massive amount of money incarcerating so many people. So what Carrie is doing with Crime Story is kind of try to fuse these two things,
yep,
that don't often get seen as they often kind of exist separately as two separate discussions.
I think, you know, something in early in our conversation about Crime Story that really resonated with me is that the law has been so professionalized over decades and even centuries. You know, at the essence of what I'm trying to do and what was interesting to, I think, to both of us was to, you know, put the law back in the hands of people and deprofessionalize the analysis of it. Mm-hmm. You know, there's this whole phenomenon with Court TV and Dan Abrams' site where you've got lawyers that are experts in the common law and in cases and in criminal justice reform and procedure and so on. And when you really look at it, the narratives at the heart of these things are ultimately very relatable, and they're either servicing this power structure that, you know, exists, and the same is true in politics as well. And yet we leave the coverage of the courts to professionals, whereas politics, everybody chimes.
Right.
you know?
Well, it's funny because, you know, when I was in the American history business, one of my big interests is that there's this movement, there's a whole movement for the professionalization of law enforcement and the law in the late 19th century. And this is part of something that goes even past a movement of professionalization in American culture and society and government, 150 years ago, something like, more or less. And one of the things there is a very concerted plan to transform juries from a group of people where, you know, you make your argument, prosecutors make an argument, defense attorneys make their argument, and we're just going to hand it over to these 12 people, and they make the call. And there is this movement to say, okay, a little different from that. We are going to make all of these legal decisions and then define pretty narrow yes-no questions that you can answer. And you see that where in a lot of cases where jurors are saying, well, are we allowed to make this decision? Are we allowed to do this, allowed to do that? That's not really the original concept. I mean, there's a reason why you have people who come in with no expertise at all who make the final decision. It is meant to be a deprofessionalized process. And that's why I've always been a big defender of the concept of jury nullification. And there again, there's been this, the reason we call it jury nullification is there's this big movement to say, okay, it's not really up to you what happens here. We're going to define a set of factual questions that we'll let you answer. But really, jury can do whatever the hell it wants. And there's this kind of secret in the legal system that's still the case. But there's a big thing where the judge is usually instructed to tell the jury you can't. You can't do this. In fact, jury can still do whatever it wants. And I thought of this because one of your colleagues on this project is this guy, Paul Butler,
right,
who is – he's at Georgetown, right?
He's at Georgetown Law School.
Okay,
yeah.
Georgetown Law School. And he's a big –
Kate's alma mater. Just for,
yeah,
just
there
for
you go. There you go.
Saxa, baby.
Yeah.
I'm a – law
on the you're law, on the on the board
yeah, I'm
on
a
the
law 89 grad
excellent.
Too
but you're like on the board of visitors, yeah, or regents or
yeah, board of visitors of Georgetown Law Center, yeah,
yeah, cool,
yeah, baby.
All right, so we're gonna well, okay, so Paul Butler, a former prosecutor, a very respected law professor, but a big voice in the criminal justice reform thing. And if I'm remembering right, he has long been a big jury nullification guy,
yep,
making the case that it is a proper thing and should happen more, basically.
Yep. And what's interesting about it is you can't advocate for jury nullification on a particular case. You can't –
As in the as the lawyer, as the at, defense lawyer.
As right, a defense lawyer, or even as – you got to be careful doing it as a representative of the media. You can actually
really so not yeah, just a matter of if you're a member
yeah,
of the bar.
Yeah, you can't target jurors or potential jurors in a case and tell them, you know, you have jury nullification as an option. You can't do. You can go to jail for doing that. There's a pastor.
Really?
Yeah, there's a pastor who went to jail.
Is that defined as jury tampering?
Obstruction of justice, jury tampering. And there's a pastor that went to jail for a lot. Like, he got a fairly hefty sentence for handing out leaflets outside a courtroom about jury nullification, targeted towards a specific case. The leaflets didn't target a specific case,
but
he had
targeted,
in his mind,
right.
targeting a specific case.
Huh.
And
I thought you were going to say that, like, if you're a member of the bar, you can't do it or something like that.
No, I mean, the courts really enforce these laws, even though they're on the fringe of being kind of unconstitutional.
Well, the funny thing is there is that we shouldn't, you know, we should recognize that there's a negative side, you know, all white jury, you know, looks at a case, white person killing a black person, just says, you know what, we don't want to convict. I mean, obviously, there's definitely a downside to it,
yeah,
you know,
I mean,
in variety. And you can think of lots of cases of like, hey, that person should go to jail.
Many people, I guess we're going to talk a bit about OJ in a little bit, but many people feel that OJ was a case of jury nullification. That many jurors believe that he may well have been involved in it, but there were other factors that they brought to bear and decided to make a statement. And, you know, some would argue that red state senators are engaged in jury nullification in the impeachment trial.
One of the things I want to talk about is Bill Barr, the attorney general, has been on the outer ring of this scandal. And it's always been a little unclear, like, and I'm talking about the Ukraine scandal here, what his involvement is. But he's been a huge player. And what has he been, attorney general, for like a year, about exactly?
Sounds about right.
Yeah.
A year now? And you interviewed him.
Yeah.
And, well, tell us about, this was the kind of first big interview, a crime story, interviewing Bill Barr.
So, I worked at HBO for 25 years, and part of my responsibility during the last decade of my work there was I oversaw the programming that HBO did for Cinemax. Cinemax was another pay channel, is another pay channel that HBO owned, and I started doing original shows for Cinemax. One of those shows was a show called Banshee, very violent, pulpy show about a cop who or about a guy who gets out of prison, goes to find his former lover who's in this small town, and through a series of circumstances, the brand new sheriff that nobody knows in the town dies in a bar fight. This guy is present. He assumes the identity of the sheriff, and he becomes this ex-con who's been in jail for 15 years, assumes it becomes the sheriff of this town.
Who is the actor?
A guy named Anthony Starr.
Okay.
Barr was a huge fan of the show as a member of the board of Time Warner, and I was introduced to him at a dinner. And the CEO of HBO at the time, Richard...
So Time Warner owns HBO. Yeah. Bill Barr is on the board, so he's... Okay.
Yes. I didn't actually know. I didn't know that, but that's interesting.
And there's aspects of the... of the whole AT&T merger that, story for another time. but the CEO at the time, Richard Plepler, suggested that I escort Barr down to North Carolina where we were shooting the show. And so we took the Time Warner jet and we flew down there for a day. And he sat with, watched the filming, and then he sat with the actors and the director.
And this is what, like 5 or 6 years ago? More or less.
Yeah. Maybe even less, like four. It was really fairly recently when you think about it. And he just really enjoyed it. And so as I was starting Crime Story, I called you and I said, he sent me a really appreciative letter. My brother, who runs the Miller Center, the policy center at UVA that focuses on the presidency, actually met with Barr afterwards, and he's given two oral testimonies to the Miller Center as part of his work from previous administrations. And so we had a friendly relationship, and I asked you what you thought of his. It was a good idea for me to reach out to him. I sent him an email. I sent him an email, and an hour later, the news emerged that Mueller's report was on his desk. And I was like, I'll never hear back from him. I sent it to his personal address. I said, never hear back from him. And an hour after that, I got an email back from Barr saying, yeah, I didn't realize you'd left HBO, Carrie. I'd be happy to do it. I'm a little under the gun right now, but I'd be happy to
do it. I remember
when
you told me that email, I had a moment of like warming to him. Like, okay, you got a sense of humor.
Sure, right? Yeah.
And in the email, what I focused on was... the First Step Act had just passed the Christmas before, and I focused on two things: criminal justice reform.
And remind us what the First Step Act is.
The First Step Act was an effort, a bipartisan effort, to look at revisiting sentencing of criminals and a general criminal justice reform package that was put together by progressives and progressive Democrats and libertarian Republicans to help get people out of jail and to begin to address decarcerating America.
Right.
And so I emailed in my email to Barr. I said, look, I know that we probably disagree on a lot politically, but I think you know, I'd like to discuss this, the First Step Act, and I'd also like to discuss narrative in popular culture about justice, because you're a fan of Banshee. There's a lot of kind of themes of justice and notions of justice in Banshee. So I said those are the two areas I want to talk about. You know, implying I don't want to talk about
We're not
going to
talk about Mueller, right?
Yeah,
right, right.
Like, and so there was a bit of a back and forth, and finally that was in April, and then in June I emailed him saying I was going to be in the D.C. area. Could we meet? And he emailed me back, and he said, "Yeah, I can make time for you. Just work it out with my secretary."
Mm-hmm.
And so I did, and in fact, I was in Charlottesville, Virginia, and I drove up on a Wednesday, and in Culpeper, Virginia, I got stopped by a cop for speeding, and I was like going 60 in a 50, and I was like, should I? Yeah. And I pulled out the email and I showed the cop the email. This is where I'm going. I just was a little confused.
Oh, the Bill Barr
email? The Bill Barr email. And the white cop in Culpeper, Virginia let me off. And so that was my use of white privilege right there. Anyway, so I went to visit. I sat down with him. And in prepping for the interview, I had several conversations with Paul Butler. I'd known Paul through my work at Georgetown. When I was at HBO, I worked on a show called The Night Of, a miniseries with John Turturro.
Great show.
Called The Night Of. And that was written by Steve Zaillian and Academy Award nominee for The Irishman. He wrote and directed The Night Of, and it was also written by Richard Price, famous novelist, wrote Clockers, also wrote On the Wire, writes on this new HBO show, The Outsiders. And we did a symposium at Georgetown with the two writers of the show and four Georgetown law professors, including Butler. And that was really my first extensive interaction with Paul, and he was just amazing, I found. And his ability to talk about the criminal legal process, particularly as it impacts people of color, I thought was profoundly on point. And so I had a couple of conversations with him, particularly as I was getting ready to start the site, about his potential involvement in it. And then when this came up, I told him about it, and he was extremely helpful and generous with his time and just helping me zero in on what I should ask. And he brought to my attention that Barr was at the heart of the planning of the increase in building prisons and imprisoning people as part of the war on drugs, he wrote the paper on it. And although most of the increase happened during the Clinton administration, mm-hmm. and there's a whole complex history of how that happened, but Barr was in many ways the architect of our carceral state, where we had an increase over the course of 25 years of five times the number of prisoners in the United States. And so we've gone from having 5% of the world's prisoners and 5% of the world's population to having 25% of the world's prisoners and 5% of the world's population. And so Paul helped me prepare the questions that I asked him. I went in and talked to him about what his feelings were about criminal justice reform, how his views had changed or whether they'd changed. And you can hear the interview on our podcast and on our platform, on our website. But I also asked him about
and just for the podcast, they could go into iTunes and search Crime Story and it would pop up and they can find it.
Yeah, the Crime Story podcast, Carrie Anthola's, because there's a lot of crime story out there.
Right.
But the other thing that I asked him about was justice as a theme in popular culture. And he asked me to pause the recording for a second. What are you getting at here? And I said, you know, well, like Dirty Harry, there's themes of justice there. He goes, okay, I got you. And so he had a whole spiel on justice and the idea of justice and justice as a process. And Butler, in helping me deconstruct the interview afterwards, zeroed in on this notion of Barr as in with a very instrumentalist view of justice. Justice is a tool for him. And when you look at his perspective on the way that he's used his office on behalf of the Trump administration, when it comes to dealing with kind of tough on crime policy, he's using justice as a cudgel. When it comes to dealing with executive power, he's using justice as a defensive tool. And so, you know, there's an inconsistency there, but it's not an inconsistency if you have an instrumentalist view of the office. You know?
Well, tell us, because in that interview, I want to get a little more specific, because he talks about this show Banshee.
Yep.
And so and that I think that illustrates it a little more. So tell us about that part of it.
You know, it's Banshee was kind of a hit cult show, and it had at the heart of it this guy who's pretending to be a cop. Essentially executing justice on a way that, you know, was fair to him, seemed fair to him. You know, it wasn't about enforcing the law.
It
was about just doing what seemed right, you know, making sure bad people were put away and good people were protected.
So like Robin Hood-esque kind of thing?
Yeah, or Dirty Harry-esque in certain ways. But there was also...
Well, there's also... Can I say one thing there? That there's an aspect of this, and you see this in cinematic representations of crime, that there is a certain vision of justice which is certainly not adjudicative. It's more like, look, there's bad people and there's good people, and the bad people need to be hit and the good people need to be protected. And like, whether the bad person has committed this particular crime is not really the issue. It's the bad people need to be punished. And you kind of
And
you see that coming out in a lot of. It sounds like that's his thing.
Yeah, I mean, one other bit of a digression, but there's this whole Ukrainian mobster component to Banshee that, like, you know, comes up periodically. It's kind of coincidental or not. One of the things Barr cites in the course of the interview is, in a Dirty Harry movie, there is a scene where a woman's been kidnapped. Dirty Harry's trying to find out where she is. He's got one of the perpetrators under gunpoint. The perpetrator laughs and sneers in his face when he's asked, where is she? And Dirty Harry shoots him in the leg, and the perpetrator tells them where she is.
And isn't the point that the perpetrator is basically saying, you know, you're the cops, you're restrained by law, you're not going to shoot me. And implicitly, Dirty Harry's response is like, no, I'm not. I'm justice in that sense of justice. I'll shoot you. Maybe I'll shoot you in the head. So you can't be, you can't hide behind fairness with me.
Right.
I'm not constrained by that.
Exactly. And Barr pointed to that as an expression of justice that touches people on some visceral level. And, you know, I did that interview in June, but I didn't launch the site until August. So it was released in August, and 2 days after that, Epstein died in prison. And so people who had listened to the interview all of a sudden were like, wait a minute, what's going on here?
Yeah.
But they were temporally very distant from one another. But, you know, when you think about justice as in kind of from as an instrumentalist tool, the Epstein suicide becomes, you know, all the more questionable.
Right. Just for the interest of time, I know, Kerry, you were talking about how this – is it this weekend? Is it 25th anniversary of the OJ?
Yeah, the beginning of the OJ trial was January 25th, 1995.
It's interesting. As a somewhat young person, the OJ trial, I think, was kind of the first news event that I remember. I want to say I was in, like, second grade. I was probably, like, 8 or 9 years old. And talking with friends, like, on the playground or something, like, oh, did he do it or is he guilty? Not knowing really – almost anything about the facts of the case, but it was such a moment that it broke through even to like a child, you know?
Now OJ is OJ, right? Killed his wife, got away with it, then sort of karmically, I think, had the book thrown at him kind of unfairly for something totally unrelated, but sort of going back to justice, like kind of like, you don't totally get away with it, right?
Right.
But again, for me, and I think this is probably the case.
But he's out now.
Like, right, but he was in. Well, later, was he in for 4 or 5, like yeah. 6 or 7? I mean, a significant.
More than that.
Was like it more recently?
Eight, 9 years.
More recently, like, it was tax.
No, it was, or it, no. Was this was bizarre thing that was technically
shoplift, like theft.
He was recovering memorabilia right. that he believed had been stolen and was being sold
right.
on a marketplace, and he was in a room, and somebody had a gun, and so he was charged with robbery, and they threw the book at him.
And it was one of these things where his.
It was like his a second bite at the apple.
His defense was pretty legit. I mean, it seemed like the people probably had stolen something from him and that he was getting it back. Someone else had a gun. So it was the second case is a good example of this too, because I think there's a pretty good case, a pretty good argument that if you isolate the second case, look at it purely on the merits, he got kind of railroaded. For yeah. that. But obviously the backdrop is, yeah. look, you got away with killing your wife and that other dude. So like, you know, yeah. so, what goes around comes around.
So next week on Crime Story, I am presenting two sets of interviews, one with the guys who wrote The People versus O.J. Simpson, the miniseries that was on FX with John Travolta and others. And also an interview that I did with Ezra Edelman, who produced and directed O.J. Made in America, the ESPN documentary, 10-hour opus on it. And it's, you know, I find it really interesting with, you know, 25 years of history behind us since the trial and with a few years since those projects came out, to look at the way that those two teams of filmmakers approached telling this iconically American story. And then tomorrow I'm going to do an interview with Bill Hodgman, one of the prosecutors on the case, and get his views.
Now, what was his role? Because we know about Marcia Clark Chris Darden, as they were the sort of the faces. Where does this guy fit in?
Hodgman was kind of behind the scenes, a very effective prosecutor. And
were they reporting to him? Is that the sort of the relationship?
It's a little more vague than that, but involved somehow. Yeah.
Okay.
And what I want to, and he was really instrumental in Ezra Edelman's understanding of what happened.
And this is the documentary.
Yeah. The documentary.
As opposed to the dramatization.
And if you watch the documentary towards the end of the film, Hodgman helps take us through what the probably the most compelling theory of what happened. Certainly the theory that Edelman ultimately adopts is
factually how the crime went down,
yes,
basically?
Yes, okay. Based on crime scene photos
right.
and a lot of the physical evidence. In any event, what I want to talk to Hodgman about is his views of the way the media covered the trial and both of these pieces of cultural history now, and how as someone who lived through it, how he sees the media representations and the way that history will remember these trials. Because I find that, you know, the difference between the experience of people who live through these histories and through these crimes or through these crime stories and the way that history remembers these things is an interesting has an interesting tension.
Well, yeah, that's occurred to me. We were talking a little bit off air, and Josh, you mentioned the figure that OJ was before the crime, you know, the football player or the likable actor.
And charismatic, yeah.
Right. And, you know, I was, I think, 3 months old when the trial started. So I've only, you know, learned about OJ in any kind of specific way. Honestly, I remember I learned about the car chase for the first time in one of my like college TV classes and stuff like that. So to me, it's so interesting hearing that there was any kind of
a pre-story to OJ sort of.
Right. Yeah. That for sure. But also any kind of internal grappling with the figure that he was, with the crime he was accused of, any push and pull in that at all is like really interesting to me because I didn't know anything about pre-trial OJ. So to me, just looking back on it, I'm like, well, duh, it seems pretty obvious that he was guilty. And like, you know, I watched a CNN documentary episode that focused on it. And, you know, the kind of frenzy around it and the people who were so, you know, dead set on advocating for his innocence and stuff, just in retrospect, at least to me, is you're just like what
bizarre.
Are you talking about?
Right, right,
yeah.
Right. Well, I would say I was just now, I was trying to think of who today would be comparable, you know, to an OJ figure the way as a child I saw him in like the 70s and 80s. And look, clearly there is
Derek Jeter, Michael Jordan.
Yeah, someone like that. Although I think the additional thing is not only was OJ a sports superstar, and I mean, look, there is a obvious big race component to this. I'm a white kid. Growing up, and OJ is sort of in that. OJ was part of the first generation of African American sports stars who went beyond simply being sports stars to sort of popular culture superstars. Mm-hmm. Oh, OJ is everybody's path. You know, all that kind of thing.
You could say like. Sorry to interrupt. No, like LeBron James maybe is an example of that. Sort of a fashion icon, does some kind of social good work kind
yeah,
of thing.
Yeah, like everybody loves
huge
him.
Celebrity.
And I think, and again, what I think an additional thing is that he went from being an NFL star to not just doing like a couple cameos. He became a big movie star.
Right.
You know, and
the Naked Gun movie.
Naked Gun, and even four. Wasn't he in like Capricorn 1 or something? Like,
yep.
You know,
yep.
So, and so everybody, this has happened a few times. Sports stars go on and you know, don't just kind of do a little cameo, but actually transition to you know, doing that. And everybody kind of likes that. Like, oh, awesome, you know, funny, all this kind of stuff. So, yeah,
he was also. And Ezra's documentary gets into this in a really big way. He was at the forefront of deracializing himself.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's this part of the documentary where they go into how Jim Brown and a group of other activist athletes went to OJ and tried to get him to be supportive of civil rights issues.
And just for listeners who maybe don't know the sort of the NFL deep backstory. Jim Brown.
Jim Brown was like the OJ before OJ.
Right, right.
He was a running back for the Cleveland Browns and was the superstar. And OJ broke his rushing record in the NFL when he ran for over 2,000 yards, the first in NFL history to do that. And when Muhammad Ali was controversial and chose not to submit to the draft. People like Brown and Martin Luther King, people, you know, were looking for OJ to become political, and OJ eschewed that. OJ didn't want any part of that. And
Jim Brown was a very political figure when he was in the NFL and for long after. I mean, ironically, he's now like buds with Trump, sort of like, which is bizarre. But that's another story. But anyway, okay. So OJ, you know. not my problem.
Right.
I'm not. I'm just OJ. Yeah, that and, quote. Like, I'm not black. I'm OJ. Yeah.
Right.
And then this was right around the time of the Mexico City Olympics, where the athletes stood on the podium and raised a fist in the air, and then, you know, the kind of full circle moment of all of this is OJ's team used the race card, as Robert Shapiro put it. OJ became a kind of focal point for police mistreatment of African Americans in Los Angeles. And at the end of the trial, after OJ was acquitted, he looked at the jury and he raised the fist, that the same fist that the athletes raised in Mexico City.
And symbolically, he would have no part of what would that have been, like, 25 years earlier than that, now 50 years ago.
Right. To bring this sort of back to impeachment, OJ, you know, cynically played to legitimate grievances that African Americans, particularly in Los Angeles, had about the way that the police treated them, similar to the cynical way that, at least in my view, Trump plays to grievances that red state America has about the way that the economy treats them, the way that capitalism treats them.
It's interesting that, you know, that is such an iconic thing, the OJ trial and everything that came out of it. But there's even these, I mean, the Kardashians. You know, Kim Kardashian's dad.
Is it Robert?
Robert Kardashian was OJ's, like, longtime bud. He actually passed away very sadly as a you know, pretty young man, not that long after. But there was that was the first appearance of the Kardashians in anything anybody knew anything about, and all these things like that, these other things that sprouted off in different directions.
And interestingly, kind of tying it back to the criminal justice reform movement, Kim Kardashian has become a very effective, and you know, it brings snickers, but I am stunned by how effective she's been mm-hmm. as an advocate and how sincere her efforts are.
Yeah, I think that second point especially, because, you know, so many people are eager to pillory her and the family and everything. And, you know, when it came out in some kind of way that she was interested in going to law school and everything, and that got pilloried as well. And you're like, what are other celebrities doing?
Yeah,
you know, it's like her husband, Kanye, came into the office and gave some, like, right. unhinged performance.
And it's also, no one is more... You know, I don't care about Kim Kardashian. Like, I don't negative, positive. But she certainly before this has represented everything that is fluffiest mm-hmm. in our popular culture. Even that sort of basic concept of being famous for being famous, right?
Right.
And yet, this isn't like a one-off. It's not like one person she wanted to get out of prison, or kind of like she was into it for a month. She has kept at it,
yep.
and she, even if she's sort of, you know, inveigling herself into Trump's world to help push this along, he's president, and I completely agree. I give her credit. This is like as ridiculous as you may think she is, as ridiculous as she is. You know, she's accomplished. This is a thing.
Mm-hmm. She was speaking to the press the other day. She's got a documentary coming up on Oxygen in April about criminal justice reform, going to prisons. And she said something that I found really touching. She's raising four black children, and she sees the way that law enforcement treats black kids particularly. And anything she can do to protect her children or her friends from that kind of treatment, she'll do. And that, man, that resonated with mm-hmm. me.
Yeah. And to me, again, it's sort of like a lot of stars do, you know, they go to an event or, you know, they're big on Twitter. You know, I cannot not respect her dedication to this.
Yep.
And, you know, give her.
Yeah, and she's seen it through. She's actually not going to law school. There's a pathway to becoming a lawyer, to passing the bar, where you can do a period of internship. It's kind of harkens back to the kind of the
that
early,
used to be a yeah. way people actually a lot of people became lawyers.
Yeah.
You just intern in a law firm and then you take the bar.
Yeah, and so mm-hmm. she's on a there's a very prescribed path of interning, studying, taking tests along the way, and then ultimately passing the bar.
Yeah, that also makes more sense logistically.
Sure,
I was
yeah.
like, how in the world does Kim Kardashian go to law school?
isn't it the case, I think, and my understanding has always been that this is even more sort of the more prestigious law school you go to, that everybody I know who has gone anywhere to law school, but particular people who go into like Harvard Law School, Yale Law School, that you get out of that, you may have learned a lot, but you've learned almost nothing for actually being a lawyer in the sense of, you know, adjudicating care, you know, being someone's lawyer. And you almost, the whole bar exam thing is, that's when you actually learn how to do the nuts and bolts of being a lawyer. So it's not that surprising that you could not go to law school and just sort of learn on the job and then pass the bar.
Yep.
They're kind of almost unrelated, right. Particularly at the more kind of elite law school
yeah.
level.
So in the few minutes we have left, maybe we can just end on the impeachment trial. Carrie, I'm curious, like, what your following in it as a longtime kind of legal observer and someone who's working on the site that you're working on, is there anything that's stuck out to you? Anything that surprised you so far? We're only a few days into the trial, but
can I mention one thing? Is that Carrie? I assume you're probably not. Maybe your law license isn't up to date, but you are a lawyer.
I am, and I remain a member of the D.C., New York, and New Jersey bars, but as a retired lawyer.
Right, right.
I tend to go to my brother for information on impeachment because he oversees this policy center that focuses on the presidency, and he actually wrote a piece about impeachment for the site. I've kind of been looking at it that way. I've also been, like everyone, wondering if Bolton is going to testify and wondering if there's going to be a groundswell. But the more that I watch it, whether there's going to be a groundswell of enough Republican senators to vote for witnesses, but the more that I follow it, the more I kind of despair that it's just going to devolve into partisan, politics and a critical mass of, moderate Republican, quote unquote, moderate right. Republican senators are going to vote for no witnesses, and it's going to
yeah,
be over.
We've all obviously been involved in the kind of like nitty gritty moment to moment thing, so maybe we don't have quite the 30,000 feet view that maybe someone like you would have, but it does feel like it's probably going to be over next week, and there won't be witnesses, and that's kind of that, right? Even Trump's legal team, CNN, reported last night that they're not planning on using all 3 days available to them with the 24 hours to make opening arguments, probably like 2 days. And I'm not sure if that includes this Saturday, which is tomorrow, the day after we're recording this. They're only going to go a few hours, I think. That's the plan. They don't want to present too much of their argument on a weekend day when
no one's
quite glued to the Senate TV cameras. But
I was actually wondering, just as a sort of a factual matter, the parts that we saw on that first day when they were talking about the rules for the trial, I don't know if they could fill up 3 days because their arguments really seem to be a mix of sort of outrage, witch hunt, we weren't allowed in the skiff, and just factually, it's hard to know they don't have a lot of. There aren't a lot of facts they can contest. They can just declare that it's not impeachable, and I guess they're going to get Dershowitz to go up
right.
and say that. But yeah, I mean, this is an imbalanced thing because everybody will agree, even Trump's stoutest defenders will agree, that the managers have a lot of details to go into. There's a lot of information.
Even like Lindsey Graham was like shaking hands with
yeah,
Schiff.
Good job,
you know,
dude.
Very
yeah.
well spoken. Doing a good job laying out the case in an effective way. So
well, you know, there was a Manu Raju who he was CNN.
Yes,
CNN, great reporter that kind of very highly respected, used to be with Politico, covers Capitol Hill. And he did a hit on CNN yesterday about this question of witnesses. And he made a point that I think is 100% true, that this is not going to be four senators say, no, you know, seen enough. I got to see the witnesses. That's not going to happen. If it happens, it's going to be like eight or nine senators, because no one is going to allow like Cory Gardner to be the guy who's like, you know, I wanted to do, got to do witnesses, and him be the guy.
Yeah, you don't want to be the deciding vote.
Yeah, there's no way that they're going to let that be focused in on one person.
And is it, I mean, John McCain, obviously, speaking of deciding votes, John McCain famously, you know, gave the thumbs down on the Obamacare repeal. I guess he was at that point not running for reelection, right? He was kind of in the twilight of his career.
Is, well, I think it was clear he was terminally ill at that point. And I think he had just... I think not long before he became sick, he had actually won re-election again, I think. So there was no election anywhere, you know.
Yeah.
That was just not an issue. And obviously he was, he was one of the few who was not, you know, he had bucked Trump on a few.
But you're right. Fronts. If you're up for re-election in 2020, you're Susan Collins, you're Cory Gardner or Joni Ernst, you're not wanting to go home to your district and be like, yep, I'm the guy who kind of fucked over Trump on witnesses.
I mean, and also the primary person to watch, of course, is Mitch McConnell. And McConnell doesn't want another Obama repeal on his hands or Obamacare repeal where, you know, all the scrutiny is on one or two people to see. And then that creates a narrative of they bucked Trump, they bucked the Republicans, they bucked McConnell. Whereas if it's the critical mass, like you say, McConnell can paint it as like, you know, we discussed, we talked about it, you know, we want a fair trial too. So.
Well, that was what, you know, in that, whatever happened in that thing where he shifted the rules, mm-hmm. that's how it's going to be dealt with.
Right.
Where they didn't, you know, we didn't know what the exact internal thing was. And legislators always want safety in numbers mm-hmm. and hiddenness in numbers. And that's really the key here, that if they decide, like if a Cory Gardner guy or Joni Ernst say like, hey, I can't weather this, mm-hmm. can't, I'm not going to be able to, then they're all going to go and just kind of do it as a, you know, do it as a group. But that is really on both sides. That's the issue. Cause like, are you hearing a lot about Cory Gardner? I'm not, there's only so much they can do, but that's a mistake. Cause that's really what this is about. This isn't about the Republican caucus.
Right. Right.
It's about him. It's about Joni Ernst. It's really about the McSally in Arizona. It's up to them.
The only one who sort of seems to be breaking through as people are paying attention or focusing on is Politico had a story last night. Like Lamar Alexander is sort of the one to actually watch. He's retiring, right? He's he's kept his cards very close to the vest. But I don't know. There's some thought maybe he'd be someone who could kind of come to the side of wanting witnesses.
Isn't the idea there that he's somewhat of an institutionalist?
Yeah.
Or at least that's the lip service idea.
That's the lip service. I mean, I
but he's also very close to McConnell and he, you know.
Right.
I have one question for you guys before we wrap it up. On December 29th, the CNN reported that Moscow reported that Trump and Putin had a conversation either on that morning or the night before, the 28th. And I, you know, in the wake of and the report was that Putin called Trump to thank him for information that
like counterterrorism information.
Yes, there was a tip off about a New Year's Eve terrorist attack that was planned for St. Petersburg that the United States informed Russia about. They arrested two people. The Soleimani hit happened a few days after that. And I've never heard anyone ask Trump or the White House whether Trump tipped off Putin to the fact that he was going to hit Soleimani, because I think he'd made the decision by then,
right?
Or he was formulating the decision by then. And in the way that we tipped off Russia before we hit the Syrian Baghdadi, but I don't know about Baghdadi, but the Syrian, when we did the missile strikes on Syria,
Right.
after the gas attack. And I mean, it would be explosive if and Putin, you know, Putin or Lavrov, you know, they expressed surprise about the hit and outrage, but they also helped fashion a pathway to de-escalation. And I wonder whether in kind of mob fashion, Trump tipped off Putin to the fact that he was going to do this. And I'd love for somebody to ask the White House whether there was any conversation of that.
You know, it's always been the whole thing with the Ukraine story. The biggest deal about it to me has always been that it shows that the craziest thing could well have happened and no one would have said anything. We wouldn't have found out about it. Before that, when all these things happened, like, oh, he talked with Putin in Helsinki and he had this phone call. And you always say, like, okay, maybe it's bad news between the two of them, but they're not really going to talk about, like, oh, man, like, you know, do this, do that. But I think what the Ukraine thing told us is, like, sure, of course, probably did. And no one would have said anything about it because no one will, you know, no one will say no. No one will out him.
And especially it seems that call was held very close to the vest in the White House, because the White House didn't confirm the fact that the call even happened until 24 hours after Russia announced that it happened.
Right. I mean, the one thing I will add here is that in Syria, they have this thing called a deconfliction protocol, which is, believe me, something you want to have, because the idea is the Russian military and the U.S. military are both operating in the same national space. You don't want them to accidentally to bump into each other and things to, you know, get out of hand. So you have this protocol to, you know, kind of a phone line where you say, look, these coordinates, we're going to be operating here tomorrow. Not telling you what we're doing, but, like, we're going to be here, so don't have someone there, don't have a plane, you know, that kind of thing, just to make sure that there's no accidents. So it's possible to see the Syria thing in that light. And again, that is legitimate. It predates Trump. That doesn't mean it's all it was. And obviously this happened in Iraq, where Russia is not on the ground. So it would be different. There wouldn't be the same there wouldn't be the same rationale or the same line of communications for a kind of a limited heads up to just, you know, don't be there when we're there. But again, what the Ukraine thing tells me is, you know, they might have talked about on the call about the Trump Hotel. And it's not like anybody was going to say, okay, dude, you can't be talking about the hotel. And I got to leak this one, or I got to file a report.
Yeah,
not going to happen.
There's been reports too. I mean, the Ukraine call was sort of locked down into this secure national security classified server, right? And I think there's been reporting that it's not the only call that's been locked down like that. In fact, lots of them are kind of put in the safe, so to speak. And so
I was talking with someone about this, or maybe emailing with some reader about this yesterday, that is still the sort of the big thing that is kind of got forgotten about, that it was it was big very early in this scandal and got a lot of discussion for a short period of time, but it's been, again, you know, superseded by other things, that this isn't the only call that got locked down. And, you know, sky's the limit. That's always been the lesson of this scandal to me. Sky's the limit. And that's actually what I think Adam Schiff, in that sort of, you know, pre-closing argument, was saying late last night, or around 10:30 last night, that, you know, do you have any confidence?
You can't trust him.
You can't trust him,
right?
That's anything can happen, and he will totally do what is in his interest. So if Russia starts, you know, dumping emails again in 6 months, is he going to say, hey, you can't do that? Of course not.
Yeah.
Of course he's not going to do that. He'll probably tell him to do that.
Yeah. All right. Well, that seems like a good place to leave it.
All right. So let's remember that the Josh Marshall Podcast is brought to you by Grady's Cold Brew Iced Coffee. If you're ready to try out Grady's and ditch your coffee shop, you can get 20% off your first order at Grady'sColdBrew.com with promo code TPM, or order Grady's on Amazon.com for next day delivery.
And you can find Crime Story Podcast on any of your podcast platforms. And you can find our website at crimestory.com.
Cool.
Yeah, Carrie, great to have you. I think our readers will be super interested in what you guys are up to. So
absolutely.
Good to have
you. Thanks for coming
in. All right.
Thank you.
Later.